Hi, I'm Rana Sarkar, and you're listening to Confluence. In each episode, we dive deep into the issues shaping tech, diplomacy, and the economic recovery in disruptive times through the lenses of Silicon Valley, Canada, and the world. In today's episode, I'm joined by Baroness Beban Kidron, a crossbench peer of the UK House of Lords, founder and chair of Five Rights Foundation, whose mission is to build the digital world children and young people deserve, and one of the most influential global advocates for children's digital rights. Baroness Kidron shares her remarkable journey from her time as a photographer and filmmaker to her current position as a policymaker and global advocate for children online. In our conversation, she shares lessons from the UK's Age-Appropriate Design Code, a critical piece of legislation she's been at the center of, which we're going to get back to, and which is 1 year in. She offers advice to policymakers worldwide working to safeguard children from the downsides of technology. As a parent of three, I can think of no greater challenge than protecting the next generation from the harms of living and operating in the digital age. Since the dawn of the smartphone era in 2012, study after study has shown the vulnerability of children from self-harm and suicide to addiction, depression, and overall degradation of teen mental health. This has been a decade-long, open-air experiment on the minds of children, and we'll be dealing with the second-order consequences of this for generations. Let's dive in. Baroness Beban Kidron, it's an absolute pleasure to have you with us on Confluence, and we're so grateful for your time.
It's really great to be here, and lovely to see you again, albeit virtual.
Oh, albeit virtually. Well, many of our listeners in Canada, the United States, I'd like to kick off the conversation with your background and the background of your work. You've been described as one middle-aged woman against Silicon Valley, but today you have global support and your work to protect online children has been widely acclaimed. Can you share some of the background, because it's a fascinating journey, from your time as a photographer, a filmmaker, and to a leader in this space globally?
Yeah, well, it is I think we could call it an unusual journey. You know, I did start off life as a photographer when I was very, very young. I left school when I was 16. I worked for the absolutely legendary Eve Arnold, who was famous for her pictures of Marilyn Monroe, Malcolm X, and every American president since the war in the period of her life. And in fact, she was 99 when she died. So there was a lot of presidents. And then actually, when I was still quite young, I became a filmmaker. And so, you know, in a 30-year career, I sort of went from British television all the way to Hollywood and back. And so I made motion pictures, but I also, in between all the feature films and all the TV films I made, I always made documentaries on social issues. And it was in 2012, when a smartphone became the price point that an adult would give it to a child, that I noticed all the young people around me were changing. And I didn't really have a perspective on that change. You know, I just noticed the change. And so the documentaries, which were my sort of my own personal sort of mission within my filmmaking work, were my sort of retreat from Hollywood and haircuts and big budgets and all that goes with that. And I started making a film even before I kind of decided to make a film. I just picked up my camera and I started making a film, which ended up being called In Real Life. And in the course of that film, I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours with teenagers. And if they were going to meetups, I went to meetups. If they were gaming, I was gaming. If they were watching porn, I was watching porn. If they were falling in love online with someone they hadn't met, I was watching that. And eventually I did go with one of these young men to meet the person who they thought they were in love with at the other end. So, you know, I had that experience, and it was in the middle of that when I started to go from the kids' experience into the sort of stated philosophy of the tech sector itself that I started to find a sort of a discordant thing. And what it was that the utopian vision of the founders of the internet was that all users would be treated equally. And you kind of go at first blush, that sounds great. But the actual result of treating all users equally is you treat children as if they're adults. And when I worked that out, it was like this sort of incredible light bulb moment. And I went, but that's not right. That's not right. We don't treat kids like adults for good reason. And, you know, we can maybe get into the rest of the conversation, what those good reasons are. But at the time, I had newly been appointed to the House of Lords. You know, I had a very, very good phone book from my time as being a movie director. And I literally tried to tell everyone. I tried to tell in tech. I tried to tell them in politics. I tried to tell the NGOs. I go, hang on a minute. We've got a problem here. They're treating the kids as if they're adult. And the hundreds of hours that I've just seen, I can see what the problem is. And it's not just the problem of contact, although it is a problem of contact. You know, bad people meeting kids. It's not just a problem of content, although it is a problem of content, but it's actually a problem of what you expect your product or service, what the outcome you expect if you treat a kid the same as an adult. And that goes from everything from not sleeping through the night and doing lousy at school to actually, you know, sort of performative metrics and you know, social comparison and so on. It means something different to a kid. We've got an emergency. I got to tell you, Rana, no one was interested. Yeah. And I am amused by the way you've introduced me by saying one woman against Silicon Valley. That's what it felt like at the time. Now, I would say, you know, it's more with than against Silicon Valley. And I think Silicon Valley itself, you know, if it had a singular voice, which it doesn't, if it had a singular voice, might actually agree with me that we actually have to have special arrangements for the kids. Yeah. Now we can still argue, and we still do argue on a daily basis, what those arrangements should be. But I think the principle is one. And as you yourself said, I now have very, very many fellow travelers. And the only addendum that I'm going to give you is I ruined my own career because I no longer make films, but I do this day in, day out, because nobody would do it. And that quote comes from my husband, who said, are you sure you want to give up this fantastic career to do this thing, One Woman Against Silicon Valley? And I went, you know, pain of consciousness, darling, what can I do? I've seen it. I can't unsee it. It is a generational injustice. And that is how serious I think it is.
With this background, we delve into the regulations to protect children online, beginning with the UK age-appropriate design code.
Oh, that's terrific. And the night is young on your film career, I imagine. So there are moments for that as well. Coming back to UK's age-appropriate design code, which I think for many of our listeners, some have heard of it, but most might not have a good sense of what the detail of that code is. And it came into force in September 2021. But can you outline some of the key provisions in that legislation? And how would you assess the impact of that thus far in this year? And what are the challenges that you see in terms of developing additional measures? And in this step, I know that there's an effort to amend the Online Safety Bill as well, that you're involved with following the Molly Russell inquest. And I wonder if you could give us an update as to where you are.
So let me go to the beginning and say, you know, the age-appropriate design code really is, the simplest way of understanding it is a product safety regime, yeah? Because how it sets itself, you know, its focus is, it says, do a data impact assessment to check how your processes and features impact on children. And if they impact poorly on children, mitigate, redesign, disable, depending on what the problem is, for the benefit of children. And then you're compliant. And the sorts of things it is looking at, it has 15 standards, and there are 14 which are very specific, like, you know, data minimization, only take what the child thinks you is reasonable to take, you know, only what you need to do the exact service that is expected. Do not share, do not sell data. Do not profile a child, do not profile them to offer them detrimental material. That is to say, if a child does in fact search for detrimental material, that's not your problem service. Yeah, that's what the user's doing. But you may not then go, oh, they like that, and target and recommend that material to them. And we'll come back to that in the Molly Russell piece. So all of this is encapsulated in a set of principles that mean that you must always put the best interests of the child first. And actually, many lawyers from different parts of life will say that the concept of best interest is very, very evolved in law. And in fact, our own regulator said to the companies, you know, it is unlikely that a commercial consideration would trump the best interest of the child. And I think most of us can kind of go A, B, A, B. Is it good for a child? Is it bad for a child? Generally speaking, these things are not that gray. But that's the overarching thing. I think the piece of it is it defined a child as a person under 18. And that is in line with the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which unfortunately America is not a signatory to, but 196 countries are. And so it stopped the sort of the tragedy of COPPA, which is to start adulthood at 13 online. No parent, no teacher, no sister, brother thinks a 13-year-old is totally adult. So it moved the digital age, if you like, up to 18. And I think then finally, its other great principle was that all of these things must be done by design and default. That is to say, you, the provider of the service or product, have this responsibility. You may not just get a bunch of tools and say, kids, look after yourself. Yeah, here, you can block, you can stop, you can download. It all has to be done by default. I think that the second part of your question is, what did we see happen? Well, it was extraordinary. Many of the companies that, you know, the household name companies, you know, so Google made autoplay off by default for under 18s. When you went in the app store, you couldn't see over 18 apps if you were under 18. They did all sorts of things on YouTube around age assurance, and hundreds of thousands of underage kids were kicked off YouTube. You know, the material that was rated higher than the age. Instagram turned off direct messaging of strange adults to children, as did TikTok, in fact. And you know, when you actually extrapolate that and say, does anybody in the world think it's a great idea for a stranger adult to be able to direct message a young kid? Everyone looks appalled and go, was that legal? And the truth is, it was. It's been operating for years. And I think one of the more interesting ones, I mean, there are hundreds of thousands of these, you know, this is just sort of emblematic. But I think the one that I find most interesting, and I think sort of gives people a vision of what kind of digital world we could have, is that TikTok turned off notifications at 9 p.m. for under 15-year-olds and at 10 p.m. for under 17-year-olds. And the reason that I find that so interesting is that there is absolutely phenomenal research that says kids are tireder than they used to be. They don't learn as much as they don't have the concentration. And then teachers say we can only teach as the slowest member of the class. So if you think about the implication of that, you know, that the slowest member of the class, one who's been up all night being notified through the night, is the one who determines what the rest of the class are learning. Yeah, that's not a happy situation. And the mere fact that TikTok could give itself a bedtime instead of the child was really, really indicative of the spirit of the code and the kind of world that we want. It's not, you know, it's so much deeper than bad content or freedom of speech or so on. It's about the machine and how it behaves towards the child. You know, I think that in the UK, everybody was surprised and pleased about the response, but there have been and there are some compliance issues that we've seen a couple of notices from the ICO. It's relatively early in the compliance thing. I have a number of cases with other organizations or with Five Rights, which I chair, that we're looking at. And I think one of our most interesting cases is with a gaming company, which I won't actually name, because when we complained first to them, they went, hands up, we're not complying with the code. Will you help us comply? And we have said we won't take them to the regulator, providing that we can publicize their compliance so that it can be a marker for other gaming companies. I mean, in the end, I want compliance, not punishment. Yeah, I want to have kids online having a good time in a safe and private environment. I don't want loads of court cases. They take a long time, cost a lot of money. And I'm not young enough to spend, you know, decades in the court with a tech company, nor do I wish to. So I think that's it. And then maybe the final piece of your question is really in, you know, the great pleasure and sort of optimism in the fact that we are now, you know, Ireland did the fundamentals, which is pretty well a carbon copy of the code, that a number of European countries are working on it, as indeed Europe as a whole, working on a system that very much mirrors the code. As you've seen, that California passed the California Age Appropriate Design Code, which is exactly to the same principles. And I believe that Indonesia is about to make a move. And in fact, we're currently in conversation with three countries in South America. What we're beginning to see is an approach to regulation that is tech friendly. And that doesn't mean it's easy. It means it's about saying, you've got the technology, you've got the creativity, you can comply however you like, so long as the outcome, yeah, is good for the kids, i.e. in their best interest, according to these principles, which are indeed quite tough. So I think that, you know, the fact that it has moved in such a short time in legislative terms into so many territories, and we know that there's a whole ballooning. And I think that there is gradually, you know, incrementally, an appetite within the tech companies to maybe make it a global standard. And, you know, obviously they're reluctant because regulation is not their middle name. But equally, I think that they are beginning to see that it's smart legislation, it's smart regulation. And actually, when you see popping up everywhere lots of different regulation, a lot of it is less focused on outcome and more focused on individual companies or individual aspects of companies, less systemic in its nature. And I think ultimately, you know, if the tech sector is going to be a regulated sector, which it is, it's better to have, you know, a global standard of regulation rather than something different in every jurisdiction. So I think that they put it this way. I'm not going to say anybody's embracing it. I'm going to say they resist it less forcefully.
In all of this work, it's critical to consider the views of children and work with them to design effective policies and regulations. Bernice Kidron explains her collaborative process.
Just to come back to a point you made earlier and what brought you to this work is that I've noticed as a, you know, parent of teenagers that the kids themselves are looking for boundaries. I wonder if you've seen that reflected in any of the work that you're doing as well.
Oh, I'm so happy you've raised it. I'm so happy you said that. So one thing I'd just like to say is that from the very beginning, remember, I wasn't a politician. I was a filmmaker, right? So I was, from the beginning, I did things in perhaps an unusual way. And my first thing to do, having spent all that time with young people, was to work out how to help them understand that it was not their behavior, but the behavior demanded of them, that was at fault, so that I could then get them to contribute to the understanding of what must be done. And I tell you two things. One is that at that time I set up deliberative juries of children within academic institutions so that we could help explain the world to them. And we used actors and scenarios that they told us about and that they then completed the answer to, Yeah. So we sort of start a story, you know, and there was a wonderful one, which was someone going shopping. It was an actor going shopping. And every time they went shopping, a Coke can was added to them, you know, so that they ended up walking with loads and loads of Coke can. And those were the cookies. And we're saying, you know, is it fair? Is it fair that all of these people are following down the street, and they didn't like that? And so they said, this is what should happen, and this is what should happen, and so on. So first of all, I want to say that every piece of the work that I do through the foundation Five Rights is done with workshops of young people. And that's why we feel very confident that we speak on their behalf. The second point, and many of the workshops end up with these design things. The second thing I want to say, which is something very personal to me, that I told you at the beginning that the code has 15 standards. Well, three or four of them at general, like best interests or better tools or redress, but I could give you a name for about 11 of those standards. The name of a child whose story or whose contribution over the years has meant that is, you know, Peter, Molly, Ella, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Oh. Yeah. Angua, et cetera, et cetera. All of them. I can tell you which young person said what that made me realize this was the problem. Now, they're not in there as individual problems of one child. They're there as systemic things. But it was one child who had their profile and was battered and battered and battered with harmful material. And you go, it's not the problem that they looked. It's the problem that it was chasing them for months and building and cascading and pushing them so they could never get away. That's one standard. The GPS off was a young boy. I won't give his name, but a young boy who was followed in real time because they could see where he was. That's that person, et cetera, et cetera. Each of those things are really emblems of how privacy and safety are intimately connected, and how the design of the service could be a lot less toxic and a lot more supportive, you know. And it's probably important to say, you know, to anyone who's listening, is the code is not, you know, it has no ceiling and it has no aspiration. It's a floor. It's sort of a basic product safety. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Have you thought about the other? What have you done? Is it good enough? It's really basic. We need a floor below which no company should go to protect kids.
From here, we evaluate legislation to protect children online in other jurisdictions, including the United States and Canada. We discuss how legislators can work together, sharing best practices and borrowing from each other.
I mean, you did work with the state of California, and who recently adopted legislation to protect children online. How do you rate those efforts, and how do they compare to what the UK or others are doing?
So the particular bill that Governor Newsom has signed, the California Age Appropriate Design Code, is a real mirror image of the UK code. And we're really grateful to the state legislators for really understanding the importance of staying close to the same thing, so that we could actually argue to the companies, A, you're already doing it, and B, this is not different. You won't have to do the same thing twice. You have to do it for your product, and then you will be compliant in California and in the UK and in Ireland and, you know, et cetera. I don't want to ever suggest that this code is going to solve all the problems of children online. It's a data protection code. It's a design code. Actually, you know, if you really follow the spirit and the letter to the nth degree, it would go a very, very, very long way to making a product safe. But there are other things to do around kids and tech. And I think that one of the things that has been very useful with the experience of the code is to establish an approach that you look at it from a risk-based perspective. So if you create no risk, there's nothing to do. Yeah. No stupid regulation for the hell of it. You do it on an assessment of risk basis. And you do, and you measure it on the output. And I think that that gives us a clue for things like the online safety bill here, maybe some of the things you're doing in Canada, you know, of how to be smart moving forward and how to come to terms with the sector to say, look, all we're doing is saying you have to behave like the automobile industry. You know, you don't get to ship a car with no good brakes. In fact, you can't choose whether your brakes stop you in 30 yards or 60 yards. Yeah. They got to stop in 30 yards because that's the law. We're just saying stop shipping this stuff with no thought to privacy or safety. Yeah. And I think that from a California point of view, how successful will it be? I think depends on the next steps. You know, there's a working group being established. There's a rulemaking group. I'm really, you know, hopeful that they will look overseas and say, actually, look, they're doing quite well over there. We'll borrow what's good of it and we'll add a bit of our own. Obviously, the regulatory context is different in that you've got CCPR in California and we've got the GDPR in UK and elsewhere in America, there isn't that. And, you know, and so one has to confront all of those things. But, you know, I really honestly think that it's shameful that there hasn't been federal legislation on this issue. We've heard from Biden that he, you know, that he thinks that this is a generational issue. He said so in the state speech and he tweeted it out after. We have evidence in every household across the land that this is an issue. Yeah. So we got academic evidence now. We didn't have that 10 years ago. You know, we got Francis Haugen evidence. Yeah, we've got the evidence that we have here in Europe that we've created avatars to show what is happening to kids, and we've got evidence from children's own mouths. Enough already with quarreling about the problem. Let's get to the solution. And the one thing that, you know, that I urge my fellow lawmakers is, you know, this is not a legacy project for any one of us. Yeah, this is actually really a legacy project for the next generation of kids. Yeah. This lot have not had a fair or equitable experience online. Yeah. And for that, I am sorry. And God knows I tried everything in the book to make it different. But for the next generation, and I think the lawmakers need to work in unison, and we have to borrow, you know, the advances of others. So I look very carefully at Australia's e-safety commissioner and try and pull that in. I look very carefully at the DSA and see how that might be better, you know, articulated in our own UK legislation. I encourage people to take our code, use it wherever they can in the world. And I think that there is a great deal for all of us to do, because one of my biggest sort of worries for the future is that in the end, we negotiate a reasonable settlement in the developed world, yeah? And then we outsource bad tech to the global south in the way they did the baby milk, right? And I'm saying we need a global settlement so that the default to the kids who are coming online, who are gonna come from the global south, you know, probably a billion of them, yeah? That they get the default settings we're negotiating here. And that is so important to me. I do know that Canada does sort of see itself as a sort of a, you know, as a, I don't know, as a pathway, as a, you know, reaching out.
Well, I was gonna ask you about that. I mean, speaking of federal legislation and contributing to this kind of borrowing approach and also sort of innovating, cross innovation across jurisdictions, which I think has been extremely helpful in all of these different pieces of legislation that are going forward in different jurisdictions, as you've been saying. And so Canada, we've had the benefit of seeing other approaches being tried, and both on the, you know, what tends to work and what in this process need to be. And so we have a bill that's before Parliament is, and I think you and I spoke in Ottawa a few months ago when there was a substantial bit of discussion around these bills. And it's the Our Consumer Privacy and Protection Act. It's in second reading right now. It includes new protections around data for minors. It also includes the right of erasure. However, it doesn't specify an age cutoff for what constitutes a minor. And you mentioned that age of 13 in a, and I note that in a commentary in Fortune magazine, you noted the current norm of treating a 13-year-old online fails to protect the most vulnerable period of a child's life, when they're no longer overseen closely by adults, but neither are they adults themselves. And as a parent of a 13-year-old, I know exactly that dilemma. What would you recommend as the optimal definition of a minor? And what support and opposition do you see from the tech sector or other stakeholders of these definitions?
I would urge the Canadian legislator to put in 18 as that age. And I think that, not I think, Canada is a signatory to the UNCRC, and that is the definition, and that is the place to look for definition, is the convention. And I actually also urge Canadian legislators to cite the UNCRC, and specifically to cite the General Comment 25, which is children's rights for the digital environment. Because actually children have a number of rights. They have not only rights to life and protection and all the ones that everybody's concerned about, but they also have rights to participation and to sort of all sorts of equity, from, you know, race to gender and so on. And I think it's really important to see the future of tech as actually engaging in all of those issues. And, you know, I mean, I am actually really concerned that people don't use age to cut kids out unnecessarily. And so I think both seeing it from a rights perspective and also seeing a child as someone up to 18, and also if you are quoting that, you see the evolving capacities of children. That is to say, you know, you can treat a 17-year-old different from an 8-year-old, yeah? You don't have to have one service. And I think you have to be really clear in those moments that this is a sector that offers personalization as its MO. We know what you like, we know what you want, we know who you are, we know what to sell you. That is what they do, yeah? And so to suggest that personalization around age or age range is an anathema, when personalization around music tastes or the size of your shoe is perfectly reasonable, is just to misunderstand what the issue is. I think the other thing in Canada is, you know, and I haven't looked at the current bill, I did look at the previous bill, you know, is I would love to see, you know, a mirror code in Canada. I mean, why not? Why not do what California did? Why not do, you know, what's happening around the world, rather than to have something different? And in the place of a whole bill, you can literally have a copy code in the middle of it. And then anything else that Canada wants to make sure of can be in some other part of the bill. So I would argue that. And I don't argue that simply, you know, as architect of the UK code, but as someone who is desperately trying to create a global norm. And I think that Canada is at a crossroads of many things and could have a huge responsibility there. I think the other thing is, there is something else, which is people love to say, this is very complicated, or they love to say, we can't put the genie back in the bottle, or they say, you know, it's so big, X, Y, and Z. You know, I think that it's very, very worrying how little lawmakers understand about the systemic approaches to regulation of this sector. It is preposterous to suggest that we can have some norms around finance, that we can have some norms around manufacturing, that we can have norms around medicines that mean that people are protected to a reasonable degree in those areas, and that they can understand those norms, but it's too difficult to understand tech. It's simply not acceptable. And I think that when they don't understand, then they start to grasp for, and I'm sure you'll have it in Canada, is they go, we must have age verification for pornography. Yeah, well, what about self-harm? What about chasing a kid so they look at a trampoline and 15 clicks later, they're being offered a diet for 400 calories a day? Yeah, what about that? And you asked me right at the beginning about Molly Russell. And I want to say only really one thing about Molly Russell, which is that in the court every day were the kinds of hacks and journalists and of all sorts from all sorts of places every day who cover tech, yeah? And in the court were lawyers who regularly do inquests. And in the court were some other observers. And I can honestly say that in the period of the 2 weeks of evidence, every one of them cried buckets, yeah? And every one of them understood something in a way they'd never understood it before. What they understood was that the system that she started looking over the parapet, and once she started looking, that she was bamboozled, overwhelmed, a tsunami, 1,400 recommendations. Even after she died, they were recommending graphic self-harm, the like of which the people who interrogated it, the lawyers and police, had to be given professional support, time off in lieu, and only do 15 minutes at a time. Now that is happening in the bedrooms of children all over the world, and yet lawmakers want to deal with pornography. I absolutely think there should be age gating on pornography, unequivocally. But to think you've done your job once that's over is to misunderstand what's going on here. And the sort of depression and body dysmorphia that's going on, particularly if you want to look around John Haight's work in teenage girls, is unacceptable. And you cannot have a safety bill or a privacy bill that doesn't actually deal with it at a systemic level.
Keeping these powerful recommendations in mind, Baroness Kidron and I discuss the challenges faced by legislators working to protect children online, from bipartisan divisions to free speech arguments.
What are the biggest challenges? This is an extremely powerful argument, and I think that, you know, where we are with when presented the way that you have, and other legislators, and even the discourse today as of 2022, it's hard to see how legislators just don't act on this tomorrow afternoon. But what are the biggest hurdles to getting these pieces of legislation over parapet, as it were? And what are the kind of strongest or most used counter arguments that you're hearing right now?
I don't know whether this is controversial or as we say here, bleeding obvious, that I think the biggest hurdle is the parlous state of politics around the world, where you look in every country and it seems that the most important thing for each of the parties is to non-cooperate, to pull down, to separate, and so on. And that has given the sort of incredible inertia in politics, where politicians have learned to live with the idea that they don't pass laws and that they don't get things done. You know, that is the biggest hurdle, period, yeah? Which is an irony, because actually this particular issue has a lot of bipartisan support. Right? So you kind of, politicians got comfortable in doing nothing, yeah? And yet all of them think something should be done. That's a terrible, terrible sort of state of affairs. All right, if you put that on one side and talk to the arguments, I think there is a sort of a muddle between, you know, freedom of speech, so, you know, and access to material. You know, and I think my best way of talking about it is, you know, I mentioned earlier that you have to think about the best interests of the child. Well, I think it is in the best interest of the child to be able to access Wikipedia. Now, in Wikipedia, how to commit suicide, you can look at bestiality, child sexual abuse, all these things that we don't really want kids to be involved with, but you can. The difference is that once you've looked at it and you have to search it and you have to think about it, it does not chase you for the next year, building and building into a world in which it is normalized, right? So I think the thing is that you know, this is not really a free speech argument. Free speech always is a sort of, is a thing that sits within rules about incitement and actual violence and so on and so on and so on. You know, this is actually about product safety. So I think that's the first thing. We got to just get over that. And that's why I think that data protection is a good way forward, because actually it's dealing with the engine. It's not really dealing with the material that the engine is dealing with. I'm not a big take it down person, as it happens. I'm really, you know, more interested in other things. I think the other thing that is a bit of a tripwire is really, why kids? Why should we treat kids differently? And the answer is, we have a duty of care to children. The answer is, kids don't have any electoral capital. They can't speak for themselves. They can't vote for themselves. And the other thing is that actually, you know, most people can see the damage in their own homes, in their own schools, you know, in their own environment. And I think what is, you know, sad to me is that actually the voices against are very, very few, but they are loud. And the voices for are very, very many, bipartisan, all over the world, but they are not heard. And I think, you know, you have to look at where the power is, follow the money, and wonder why the loudest voices seem to protect the commercial interests of the companies.
We wrap up our conversation looking forward with advice for the tech sector and a call to action for policymakers in Canada and beyond.
Well, I want to sort of conclude our conversation by asking you where you see some hope in this next phase that we're entering into of the conversation. Because I agree with you. I think that we are, whereas the conversation in the past has been muddled by a variety of different forces, from the inaction on behalf of governments, but also the arguments in the public sphere have often been confused. But we're getting to a place now where we have these codes, we have, you know, the potential for even regulators being stood up. The harms conversation has become much more mainstream, and we're finding ways of using old institutions or reconstituting old institutions to take in digital concerns. And so I would say that we're potentially on a hopeful trajectory right now. But I, you know, as somebody who does this every day, where do you see a hope in this conversation for future action? And also, where would you give advice to people who are looking to be helpful, wherever they sit in the spectrum? And we have many listeners of this podcast who are legislators or are people engaged in public policy and diplomacy, but also people who are engaged in building products from the tech side.
We've touched on some of the optimistic bits. I mean, I think there's a new generation, and that generation is not, you know, is looking for something beyond growth and numbers. You know, they're looking for something in their own lives, but they're also looking in their business for that. I think that the business model itself is looking a bit ropey, and so you just can't keep doing the same thing, and, you know, and it's not working, because it's sort of a saturation. And it's saturation sort of probably, you know, in the growth and numbers game, but it's also saturation of people's attention and saturation of people's tolerance, you know, about their relationship to tech. So I think that there's a whole generation going into tech, and I think that the old generation are going, whoops, this is not working so well. And that does create opportunity. I think the other thing we touched upon is we've got some models. You know, and I think the idea that we can't do anything is diminishing. And so then people who want to activate should start doing things because that argument is gone. And I was going to say my cheekiest thought, you know, you're a representative of the Government of Canada. They have a bill in front of Parliament. I would urge you, as soon as we hang up from this call, to get back to Ottawa and say, actually, what we should be doing is having the Canadian Age Appropriate Design Code, follow the good example of California, of the UK, of Ireland, and so on, and do the exact same thing as your contribution to the global standard, Yeah. And then work out which bit Canada's going to do that's going to advance it from then on. Don't do badly what we've done well. You know, do the next bit that we haven't done yet well, you know, and do the bit that we've done exactly the same. That is the power of it. So my optimism resides in you today. And if anybody's listening who has a similar position in other environments, be they other states in America, be they in tech companies, or indeed in other countries, I would say the same to them. You know, there are examples. We should be building the inevitability of a global standard if you want to deal with kids. It is not okay to treat a 13-year-old as if they were a fully fledged adult. They do not have the emotional, the physical, intellectual development to deal with it in a way that adults can, and they are in a period of such intense personal and physical and emotional growth that it actually perverts their very being. It destroys who they could be by nudging them by a million cuts into being what you want them to be, which is online looking at rubbish. And that's not okay. There is another world. And it's a much better world. And it is absolutely a connected, technologically led, creative, and fabulous world. Because I actually love tech. I was an early adopter. I just want it to be fair for the kids.
That's a terrific place for us to leave off. And thank you so much, Baroness Beben Kidron, for your time and for being with us and for, you know, your leadership and your passion for this effort. And I think that given what you've described and what the various efforts that are ongoing around the world, we are making progress, but it doesn't take away from the responsibility of all of us to be actors, and particularly, you know, those of us who are parents. And I come back to that point that, you know, I talk to a lot of 13-year-olds and they themselves are really looking for guardrails. And I know you've been a great advocate of that in the past. And so thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Confluence. I hope you're able to walk away from today's episode with some fresh perspectives. Additional resources are available in the episode show notes. Confluence is produced by the Consulate General of Canada in San Francisco in collaboration with Edit Audio. Special thanks to Baroness Beben Kidron for being my guest. Production thanks to Marie Alnick, Kate Walter, Augustus Clark, Steph Colburn, Kathleen Speckert, and Olivia Richardson. I'm Rana Sarkar. Thank you for listening. Until next time.